Case number 13-7105, United States of America, ex rel. Anthony Oliver, appellant, versus Philip Morris USA, Inc., a Virginia corporation formerly known as Philip Morris, Inc. Mr. Gulub for the appellant, Ms. Papez for the appellee.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
My name is David Golub, and I represent the relator, Anthony Oliver, in this action. The principal issue in this appeal is whether an internal Philip Morris memo that describes a price differential in the price charged to the military for cigarettes and the price charged to duty-free private distributors was sufficient to constitute a public disclosure of the fraudulent scheme alleged in Mr. Oliver's QI-TAM complaint. And I want to begin by identifying two aspects of this case which are undisputed and which we think help frame an understanding of why this memo does not constitute a public disclosure. First, it has been undisputed from the outset that there is a price differential between what Philip Morris USA charged the military and what its affiliate, Philip Morris Duty Free Inc., charged the duty-free distributors in the same markets. That has never been in dispute. It's never been a subject of any controversy. Philip Morris contends it's perfectly legitimate. Philip Morris contends that it sells the cigarettes it manufactures. When I say Philip Morris USA contends it sells the cigarettes it manufactures to its affiliate in arm's length transactions, that the affiliate then turns around and sells the cigarettes to private duty-free distributors in arm's length transactions. Philip Morris says these transactions are at arm's length and they are involve terms and conditions and possibly even product that's different than the product terms and conditions that Philip Morris USA sells to the military. That has always been Philip Morris USA's position in this case, and in life that's its position. Mr. Oliver's complaint alleges that Philip Morris USA uses Philip Morris duty-free as a subterfuge to avoid the MFs, the most favored customer provisions of the government military contracts. Mr. Oliver alleges that there are sham transactions between Philip Morris USA and Philip Morris duty-free, and that Philip Morris sells the cigarettes that it manufactures to duty-free at a knowingly low price so that knowing that duty-free will then resell to private duty manufacturers. And that has always been the dispute. That is the dispute that is set forth in the complaint. That is the dispute that the relator has alleged, that the use of duty-free is a sham. If Philip Morris is correct that there's a legitimate justification for its price differential, there's no false claim action. If Philip Morris is wrong, if Mr. Oliver is correct that these are sham transactions, that this is a subterfuge to avoid the MFC requirements, there's a claim under the False Claims Act for withholding information of certifications that are required under the contract. And that gets us to the second undisputed issue in this case. The existence of a price disparity in and of itself is not a violation of the MFCs, is not fraudulent in and of itself, is not illegal, is not improper in and of itself. If there is a legitimate justification for the price disparity, arm's length transactions, different terms, different conditions, different markets, different time frames, different products, if there are those legitimate transactions, there is no false claims action.
Let me ask you, in many ways, this comes down to the Iceland memo, doesn't
it? Yes,
that's correct.
Am I reading
it right? Okay. And so if I take it the theory is if one is to look at the Iceland memo, do we have fraudulent allegations in the Iceland memo?
Yes.
And your argument is that they do not exist here.
Yes, my argument
because the certifications aren't present here. Is that what turns on?
No. The argument is this. The argument is all the Iceland memo does is identify Philip Morris's
position,
which is we sell. There's a disparate price that duty-free charges, which is an undisputed fact in this case, and here's our justification. Philip Morris USA is a different corporation from Philip Morris Duty Free. Philip Morris USA has to comply with the Surgeon General's labeling requirements. It's a justification.
And your argument is there's nothing on the face of that that appears
there's nothing on the,
and to alert even goes one to the claim.
It goes beyond that, Judge Griffith, because the memo says this issue was resolved. So if you start with the two undisputed issues.
So what did the district court get wrong about the, its,
here's what
its
the district
construction
court got wrong,
of the
and here's
memo?
What, here's what Philip Morris argues on page 20 of its memo. Philip Morris argues the fact of the price disparity and the fact of the MFCs is enough to establish a fraudulent transaction. That's what the district court said, and that's what Philip Morris argues. And what we say is that's not correct. You can have a price disparity and an MFC and there not be any fraud. What Mr. Oliver brought into this case was the sham use of Philip Morris duty-free.
So are you not relying on the non-public nature of the MFC clauses? I thought that was an important part of your case, that in the framework that this court has established, if it's X plus Y equals Z, that the X is the price disparity, the Y is the most favored customer treatment, and the Z is the fraudulent practice, and the and to that extent is the Y public or not public in your view?
Well,
or am I not looking at it correctly?
Well, the answer is the MFC provisions the judge found that the court found were not public. There was no evidence of public, but that we don't think is really the key issue. We don't think the MFC provisions are the Y. We think the MFC provisions are the fraudulent scheme.
Wait a minute, but don't you need the MFC provision to get to the fraudulent scheme?
Yes.
Well, then, isn't the answer to Judge Pollard's question yes?
Yes, but what I'm really saying, Judge, is I'm trying to avoid arguing a technicality here about was the MFC known or not known.
You think that's a technicality?
No, I'm trying.
I thought it went to the heart of your case.
Well, it goes to the heart in the sense of there has to be knowledge of the MFC. But I think in a broader sense, our claim is that whether or not you knew about the MFC, you still don't have the transaction setting forth all of the essential elements of a fraud.
Well, then, do you think? Well, what's your response then to Philip Morris's argument that the knowledge? That there is knowledge of the NFC.
Well, the amendments to the 1986 to the False Claims Act specifically did away with the government knowledge issue.
So is there any other basis for their argument?
No, there is not.
That you feel you need to respond to?
I don't think.
What about the website?
Well, we made a tactical decision that we were not going to challenge the public disclosure channel in this case.
Because, the memo, the Iceland memo.
Yes, because there was a court underlying court order that ordered it to be public.
Although you did refer to it in your opening as an internal Philip Morris memo, but there's no dispute that it was posted on the website.
We are not challenging it as a published within one of the three channels allowed by the statute. What we say is that it doesn't meet the test, and the two tests from Springfield Terminal and the cases that follow Springfield Terminal, is it an allegation? Is there a conclusory statement of fraud? There is not. That no one contends there is. Do the transactions set forth, and this is Springfield Terminal and the cases that follow Springfield Terminal, do the transactions set forth all of the essential elements of the fraud? And it does not, because it sets forth is there's a price disparity and someone in the government inquired about it. What it doesn't set forth is anything to suggest that price disparity is improper, anything to suggest that there's no basis for it, anything to suggest it's not supported. In fact, just to the contrary, there is an explanation.
But does that need to be in the Iceland memo?
It does. It does because the language in Springfield Terminal, which has been followed in ensuing cases in this circuit, says if not all of the elements, essential elements, are in the transactions, the relator may bring to the table one more element and mount his case, mount his key tam suit.
Mr. Golub, is there also a question about whether the cigarettes referred to in the Iceland memo, the duty-free cigarettes, in fact, complied with the Surgeon General requirements? Or is that, am I barking up the wrong tree there?
Well, you know, what we don't get into is the, I mean, there's an explanation in the memo, and we think they did comply, and we think that they did have the warning labels that would be on it. We're not, we have doubts about whether in the final analysis Philip Morris will ever make that claim that the reason for the price disparity is because of the price cost of putting labels on. But that's one of the things they said in the memo. They say in the memo they're separate corporations and Philip Morris USA has to comply. So I'm not agreeing for the purposes of this case that this is necessarily valid, but that's the justification.
But in terms of public disclosure, that puts what was ostensibly disclosed or what one could reasonably infer from the Iceland memo on a little bit different footing from your claims, in the sense that one might look at that and conclude no fraud, different products.
Yes.
And wouldn't be alerted from the perspective of the policies behind and the statutory requirements of the public disclosure bar. One wouldn't necessarily be alerted by that memo.
Yes, and we think it's clear that there is that no prosecutor, and then this is the language of the cases, no prosecutor could bring a case based upon what's in the memo. There's nothing in the memo that alerts a law enforcement authority to fraud. It's just the opposite. It's a memo that says what we're doing is right, and this issue was resolved.
Any other questions?
No.
Anything else? Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
We'll hear from the other side.
Good morning, and may it please the Court, Elizabeth Pepez for Defendant Appellee Philip Morris USA. None of counsel's points changes the fact that the government investigated Relator's fraud claims, declined to join his suit.
Can I ask you, could you just start with Springfield Terminal and the XYZ formula?
Of course,
Your Honor. What's the X?
The X here is what I'll call the alleged true state of facts,
right,
or the price disparity.
We were
charging a different, gotcha, and lower price for duty-free,
right,
than Philip Morris was charging for military,
okay,
sales. That's
what's the Y?
The Y is the government's concern about getting the most favorable price that's embodied in these most favored customer provisions.
You don't mean concern. You mean the government's...
It's a legal, requirement.
The certification from Philip Morris.
Yes, and the legal requirement.
Do you agree
requirement.
That both of those have to be public for you to succeed here?
I think the legal requirement, yeah, that you offer the most favored price, right, does, yes, Your
okay,
Honor.
So where is the Z? I'm sorry, where is the Y?
Where is the Y?
Yeah. We've got the X. That's in the memo.
We've got the
where's
X.
Where's the Y?
And the relator concedes that. He appears to have conceded the Y as well.
Well, tell me where. He just told us he didn't. But where do you see it?
Two where places, Your Honor. It is on the Internet, but if the court doesn't want to accept that, then it is in the record before the court. It's clearly... an administrative report.
You don't argue it's in the Iceland memo.
The most favored customer requirement?
Right.
No, it's not in the
Iceland. That's not in the memo.
No.
You agree with that?
I agree, and there's no requirement.
Okay.
It need be. It's in the public domain.
Yeah, I understand that, but where is it now? Where is it? It's in the public domain?
Yes, Your Honor. The question under the statute is, has the Y that we're talking about, the most favored customer, mm-hmm, requirement, entered the public domain?
Yeah, but where?
Through one of the statutory channels. Well, the relator says this. He says it is on JA-160, page one of his opposition below. He says it's like a regulation. It is issued by these two federal agencies as a contracting requirement, and it has actually been issued to the vendors, including two in the room here, to Philip Morris at all relevant times in this suit. And he concedes this in appendix, I believe it's 14 to 16. He repeats, these were issued by the agencies, this requirement, to contracting vendors.
Is it issued only to contracting vendors as distinct from something that's in, let's say, the Federal Register or available if you look it up on CFR?
You know, it is. The timing question, Your Honor, is unclear. I mean, clearly right now, and the district judge recognizes in footnote 8 of her opinion, it's available on the Internet and it's issued in these general provisions, so it's very much like the CFR. But for purposes of the public disclosure test, issuance to even one vendor would be enough. And we know that from cases like Schindler that say, look, if the government actually produces to a single requester who asks for it the information, there is a public disclosure for purposes of the FCA. So if you have to fit this into a box, the why into a box, I'd say clearly it's either the internet disclosure or issuance to vendors, which Relator concedes. And he's never argued that these most favored customer requirements are not in the public domain. I think rightly, because that would be extremely hard to square with a lot of cases that hold that there have been public disclosures and that things are in the public domain that are far less conspicuous or ubiquitous than these contracting requirements. You know, take, for example, Graham County, which talks about some state agency issuing an administrative report that perhaps the federal government has never even looked at. That would be a public disclosure.
Isn't, though, there a more sort of formal, rather than the kind of practical distinction that you're pointing to, a more formal distinction between public documents and non-public documents? That a government report, even if it's an obscure, small jurisdiction, makes something public by, you know, issuing it, and anybody who wants to come by and have a copy can have one. And my sense was that maybe these most favored customer requirements were not in that category, that they were something that were part of agreements between contracting parties, but not necessarily publicly available to all comers.
No, Your Honor, to be clear, and I think if you want to fit it into a doctrinal box in the statute, you would look at something like the administrative report box. These requirements are work product of a federal agency, right? They develop these requirements, and then they issue them in Relator's own words. Again, I refer you to the appendix at pages 16 to 18, where he says the word issue. Appendix at page 160, he actually says these contracting requirements are like regulations. So, Your Honor,
if we aren't persuaded by that, just assume for purposes of my question that we're not. What other is that? Does your case depend on us being convinced by that argument, that no, that's a sufficient amount of disclosure?
No, Your Honor, I think we have that, and again, it's hard.
What's the other source?
Yeah, I think it's hard to say that these are not disclosed.
But
including,
understand my question.
Yes,
the question is, we don't agree with you.
Right. The answer to the question is yes, Your Honor. I think we still have enough to get the bar because he concedes the Iceland memo is in the public domain.
You just told me 3 minutes ago that it's not in the Iceland memo.
Your Honor, the most favored customer clause is not in the Iceland memo, but the question for the statute is what's in the Iceland memo enough, in this court's words, to enable the government
And you think the Iceland memo alone is enough?
What is in there that does that?
Two things, Your Honor, and this is at appendix page 71. Actually, I thought about this. I was looking at the memo yesterday. When you look at this memo, it discloses the price disparity, yes, but it also discloses something else that's very important. It discloses the fact that the U.S. government was not only asking and inquiring, in the district court's words, complaining about
The district court's words aren't quite accurate with what the document says. There's no complaint in here.
No, but they
it's an inquiry. Inquiry is very different than complaint.
They're inquiring.
Anybody buying something would inquire about lower prices somewhere else. That doesn't tell you anything about the why.
No, but let's.
I mean the letter Y.
No, but how does the test work? This is how the court said the public disclosure bar works. Is there something in the public domain? Now, on the Iceland memo, we'll all agree it is in the public domain. That memo at page 71 of the appendix
is
in the public domain.
But why is not in the public domain in the Iceland memo? I think that's the question.
Yeah,
where
do
you see why in the Iceland memo?
No, so then you have to say if the MFC...
So you,
if the
you
most
recognize favorite, why is not there, right?
Right. Okay. If the most favorite customer is not there, does that mean that we're done on the bar? And my answer is no.
Why?
And here's the reason. Because then you look at, let's look at what the Iceland memo on its own. Is that enough to satisfy this court's test for the bar? And this court says, if you look at the Iceland memo alone, now this is on the sufficiency part of the disclosure, is the what's in the memo enough to allow the government to adequately investigate the case and decide whether to prosecute? Now,
in the Iceland memo would lead anybody to undertake an investigation?
Well, it says the government's already done so. It says we're investigating why you are charging us more than you're charging duty-free customers. And on the sufficiency part of this public disclosure test, and this court said this in Quinn, and it said it in Findley, you know, something like an engineering blueprint, right, that is not readily accessible.
Where does it say the government's investigating?
On page 71 of the appendix.
Yeah, that's what I'm looking at.
It doesn't say the word investigation.
Say the word investigation.
Yeah, I was just looking at it. I didn't find it either.
In the third paragraph, it says, we, Philip Morris, frequently receive inquiries from the service headquarters, which is APHIS and NEXCOM, the actual government entities responsible for this program. Right. It's their contracting requirements that are at issue on why they can't purchase tax-free product at these lower prices.
Right. Yeah. Is that the sentence that you rely on?
And then in...
No, I'm just asking, is that the sentence?
That's one, and then the other is in the fourth.
But let's stop and talk about that sentence. That sentence just simply says, why can't we buy at the lower prices?
Right, and the test for the bar is...
But what would suggest to anybody that the result or that the reason for that is fraud?
But it doesn't have to, Your Honor.
It doesn't?
There's not a case from this circuit I know of, and in fact they go the other way.
How about Springfield? You said you have to have X and Y.
X and Y. And but the X and Y if you do the transactional formula, but you're telling me in the hypothetical, let's take Y off the table. And so I'm left with X, right? In answer to your question, you said, let's look at just X. X is the only thing in the public domain. Can I get the bar?
X, we agree, is there.
I'm sorry?
We all agree X is there.
Right, X is there. And you said, assume that we disagree with you that Y is in the public domain, so right. I'm not allowed to rely on Y. I thought that was the question.
No, that wasn't my question. My question was, what in the... And you agree you have to have Y in the public domain. And my whole line of questions is based on the hypothetical that we don't agree with you that the issuance of contracting standards to contractors is sufficient. So... Now what Judge Griffith and I are asking you is where in this memo is why, and you focus this on this line where it's asking why we can't buy.
Well, I guess maybe the where we talk past each other is, I think if you need why for the most favorite customer in the public domain, we have it. But assuming we don't, I think the question for me becomes, is there enough in this memorandum to satisfy this court's test for the disclosure bar?
I think it was, maybe I can help clarify, assuming that you do need X and Y, but that Y has not been satisfied by the issuance of contracting requirements to contractors, then where else do you find that Y component?
And that's the thing. I think it's a hard hypothetical because I think it's hard to conclude that the Y is not public. But if it's not, and you look at this memo...
Don't fight the hypothetical.
Yeah. Right. That's why I was saying, let's take the hypothetical as it is and say, I don't get Y. This most favorite customer is not in the public domain.
No, that's not the question. The question is, if it's not in the Iceland memo, where is it?
And it's not in the Iceland memo.
That's the question.
Yeah, and it's not enough for it to have been included in the contracting materials that are given to the actual government contractors. So those are two places where it might be. It doesn't appear to be in the Iceland memo.
Right.
And there's some question, I think, on our part, whether it is in the public domain through the issuance to contractors. And then the question is there anywhere else where we might look in the public domain in one of the statutory channels to find that element?
Well, again, I think it has to qualify as an administrative report because it's issued to vendors.
Okay.
So if we don't find it there,
then you lose.
Okay. Okay.
Well, no, but that's what I'm saying. I don't think I lose, Judge Griffith, and that's what I want to talk about is when you look at this memo, what this court has said.
If you don't find why there, where do you find it? Not in the Iceland memo?
Do you need why then, or is there enough in this memo to satisfy the test?
You need why. You've got to find why.
Springfield says that's certain.
You got to have why.
You got to have why.
No, Springfield uses X and Y as a shorthand, but what it actually says is what you need is something in the public domain. So let's say we're stuck with the Iceland memo. You need something in the public domain that would, quote, enable the government adequately to investigate the case and decide whether to prosecute.
So maybe one, and correct me if I'm wrong, but maybe you're saying we're not doing the X plus Y transactions route, we're doing the Z allegation of fraud route, and you find that there is in the public domain a Z? Just putting it in that.
No, I think the issue is are there transactions disclosed in this memo alone if I'm not allowed to rely on the most favored customer issuance to vendors? Is there enough of this memo alone to alert the government and allow it to investigate the fraud? I would say clearly there is under this court's precedence. And when you look at the cases, whether it's a Settlemyer or a Quinn Findlay, for example, involved a competitor relator like we have here, and what happened was there were public disclosures, and the court made the point. It said there's no requirement there be a single piece of paper that contains both the X and the Y. There's no requirement that says a single piece of paper has to use the words fraud, and that makes sense. Otherwise, Quinn's example of an engineering blueprint, which on its face doesn't say fraud, doesn't tell you that there's anything wrong afoot. It says it just has to enable the government, with its experience, to look at these transactions or facts and investigate. And we know from the record here the government investigated it in the 1990s. It's also investigated the relator's specific allegations here, complete with the conclusory allegations of fraud and sham. It has not intervened in the case and continues to contract with us. So it's well aware of the price disparity. It's well aware of its own requirements, which were disclosed to many vendors. One person is enough in the public domain.
Do you have any other questions?
No.
Okay, thank you. Did counsel have any time left? You can take a minute if you'd like it.
Okay.
I'm going to try not even to take that. I have 2 points. One point is this. The district court made a finding that there was no proof to establish that the MFCs were in the public domain, and there's no basis for overturning that finding in this court. There's no factual showing of clearly erroneous. There's nothing that is before this court that allows this court to overturn that finding. And second of all, and this goes to what the finding would have to be, under Schindler, there are 3 channels that are allowable to establish a public disclosure: criminal or civil proceedings, administrative reports, and the news media. There's no showing whatsoever that these MFC provisions, even if they were issued to an individual contractor, went through any one of those 3 channels.
Well, they were clearly administrative, weren't they?
They're not administrative reports. These are not regulations. There's no evidence whatsoever that they were ever issued in accordance to any one of those 3 channels.
I see. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you both. The case is submitted.